You are listening to a sermon by Andrei Pekovich, recorded on Sunday, September 4th, 2011, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
So, did you ever see a chestnut in its shell? We have several outside our house, street trees, and that lovely brown chestnut is hidden by a green spiky thing. They're hard to pick up. It's awfully prickly. Can't grab hold of them easily. I have a co-worker who's a fabulous raconteur and a great engineer and a personable fellow and a dedicated individual. He'll throw his all into everything he's doing, especially if he believes in it. He was an RCMP officer in the Yukon, where you have to learn how to get along with people in order to get the job done, because you're usually only one person there. It's a one-person detachment in Faro and a two-person detachment in Whitehorse, at least it was at the time. And you pretty much have to have a wife to be an RCMP officer up there, because your wife is your unpaid office staff, your call taker and dispatcher, your cleanup crew in the jail, the feeder of the prisoners, and you're unpaid as a wife. The federal government's been taken to tasks since then for refusing to acknowledge those contributions that wives made to RCMP officers. It wasn't allowing them a pension, or it wasn't allowing them survivors' pensions from their husbands. And finally, I think they are doing so after many, many years. But those were true partnerships, those RCMP officers, and Hal was one of those partners originally, with his wife. He eventually tired of the life and came back down here, and he does other things now, like hanging off bridges in the region in superhero suits. He's one of those fathers for justice who fights for access for children, for fathers, you know. So that might tell you that he's now split up from his wife. He's as prickly as a chestnut. He's gotten that way. I don't know how, I don't know why. I hear all the stories. We work together a lot, so that's why I know a lot about him. He's willing to tell me everything about his life. But he's now a lone cowboy. He's been passed over for promotion, and I think we're all the worse for it, because he can do such fabulous things for the hospital we work at. I don't know what his first wife was like, but I can only imagine where Hal would be now if he was still with his first wife, and if she was more like Deborah and he was more like Barak. So I'd like to review the passage today with that in mind and contrast it with the passage in Judges 5, which is really a retelling of the same story from Deborah's point of view. A lot of my thought today comes from Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She was a woman suffragette activist from the 19th century who wrote, with 26 other women, The Woman's Bible, that was published in 1895. It was the first attempt to really look at the Bible from the perspective of women, at least from our modern perspective. I'm sure it was done prior to that, I just don't know. I've also taken a little bit from the American religious writer Beverly Whittaker, and some poetry from Carol Ann Duffy. She's Britain's poet laureate. And all these thoughts you'll find cropping up now and again in this message today. So the passage today is remarkably difficult, especially when we get tangled up in the words. So I first turned to the message, which I've often found useful. And as I read through the message, Eugene Peterson's message, it made no sense. It completely erased the difference between some characters. It's one of those times when the transliteration simply doesn't work. And so I found another passage, this by Beverly Whittaker, which is more a storytelling of Deborah's story. And I'd like to read that now. It's from the same passage, Judges 4. That actually goes a little further. I was a homemaker, the wife of an obscure man named Lapidoth. Our house was on the road between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, where olive trees and palm trees flourished. I was the keeper of the tabernacle lamps, and as I illuminated the tabernacle, so God illuminated me. This was a time of great trouble. For 20 years, the king of Canaan had oppressed the children of Israel. Our vineyards were destroyed, our women dishonored, our children slain. Many of my people had turned to the worship of idols. I can't quite explain how it happened in a land where women are rarely leaders, but I became a judge. You see, judges are chieftains and usually heroes as well. Their influence is felt mainly in war. And war was upon us. The enemy, with his 900 chariots of iron, caused such fear that the men of Israel faltered in leadership. But I was angry at the oppression of my people. I simply burned with indignation. I felt called to rise up against such fear and complacency. In my heart, I carried the great hope that God would come to my people's rescue if we would only honor him. I went to see Barak, one of Israel's most capable military men, at his home in Kadesh. Together we worked out a plan for action against the enemy. I told him I wasn't afraid of Jabin's army or his 900 chariots. I told Barak that the spirit that could animate an army was greater than either weapons or fortifications. And I further reminded him that God had led the Israelites through the Sea of Reeds and had broken that mighty oppressor, Pharaoh. And with a God who proved himself to be mightier than Pharaoh, I saw no reason not to believe that he would be mightier than either Jabin or Sisera. Barak's answer to me was, "If you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, then I will not go." Then it was that I knew he had confidence in me. And I answered, "I will surely go with you. However, this struggle is not for your own honor. For the Lord has told me that Sisera will be defeated by a woman." With these words, the people came to know, as Barak already did, that I am also a prophet. Barak summoned 10,000 men from the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali, but none were well armed and none riding in chariots. We went forward to near where Sisera and his charioteers were. A storm of sleet and hail burst over the plain from the east, driving right into the face of Sisera and his men and charioteers. His slingers and archers were disabled by the beating rain. The swordsmen were crippled by the biting cold. With the storm behind us, we were not crippled by it. We pushed on, believing all the more in God's providential aid. The floodwaters raced down the Kishon River. Sisera's heavy iron chariots sank deep into the mud, and many of his charioteers were slain. Sisera fled through the blinding rain and managed to reach the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. He thought he would be safe there and fell asleep. But remember, I had prophesied that he would be delivered into the hand of a woman, and Jael was that woman. While Sisera lay sleeping, Jael took a tent peg and with a hammer drove it into Sisera's temples. Deborah is the earliest woman in Scripture to play a leading role in the guiding of the nation. Why I'm concentrating on her is that because I'm convinced that the Bible and the church have done a disservice to women throughout history and in many cases dismissed their contributions or relegated them to second-class citizenship, doing violence without punishment to their hopes and their lives. This despite the fact that Jewish theology, more than most, tended to view women as men and women as complementary and having equal value before God. Further, I would say that secular society itself, both then and now, continues to do the same thing. It's long past time for the world to recover the rightful place of women in our lives and our church, a place of faithfulness and servanthood. These are not graces that are largely owned by men. It's men, not women, who throughout history, as well as through the Bible, have acted in selfish and aggrandizing ways for reasons of power and glory. And it is women who have continually recalled them to faithfulness. And through this, perhaps I can find a clue to understanding and supporting my co-worker, Hal, whose marriage foundered on the rocks of anger and misunderstanding and pride. He's a good man with a bad attitude about women. Perhaps God can help. The book of Judges. This word, our word for this book, reflects poorly on the stories of the people in it. The major judges like Othniel and Ehud and Gideon and Abimelech and Jephthah and Samson especially, they did not rule on matters of law, but were instead military leaders. They were recruited by God to defend Israel. Most were not good role models for the Israelites. Jephthah sacrificed his daughter. Samson murdered his first wife. Gideon promoted the worship of fertility gods, and so on. So Deborah, the sixth of the major judges, stands apart for her wisdom, courage, and faith in God, and her willingness to speak as a prophet. Her partnership with Barak deserves careful study, as I think it's a precursor to the model of woman's leadership in the New Testament. A leadership that identifies faithful ones who recall such society to justice, peace, and third-way solutions in a world dominated by the dualistic thinking of men. Women looking for a third way between the stark two choices often offered by men. The story of Deborah occurs around 1125 BC at the apex of Canaanite culture, when the historical record shows that the Israelite settlers in the hill country of Canaan were often largely to blame for their own problems that were identified in the story. After their invasion under Joshua 100 years early, they spread out over the land, mostly on the hilltops, and continually raided Canaanite farms and villages in the valleys below. The valleys, of course, were the prosperous plains where farming and metalworking occurred. And the powerful Canaanite city-states under King Jabin of Hazor retaliated and oppressed the Israelites. This is from a careful rereading of Judges 5. This is not me making things up. That's why I've included that passage. I didn't want to go through it because it really is quite distracting, but it's useful to see the political aspects of this story. It also comes from the historical record as written by Josephus. Deborah is introduced as a prophetess, not someone who foretold the future, but rather someone who heard a message from God in some way and passed it on to the people. She did not impose her civic authority on the Israelite people. The people instead sought her out as a representative of God or an oracle. I know oracle has a bad name, but let's just put that aside right now. She held counsel sitting under a special palm tree in the hill country of Ephraim, a place where people went when they needed a dispute settled. The palm tree in this place was likely sacred in some manner and probably had been for some time, having a special aura that may have linked it to God. There are many such places like this in the Middle East. Mount Carmel, not far from here, at the other end of the Jezreel Valley, is just such a place. Carmel gets its name from Kerim El, the vineyard of El, El being the Canaanite god of high places. So many of the original, many of the Jewish names today survive from Canaanite culture. You can see how difficult it would have been for Israel to keep entirely away from the holy places of the Canaanites. Every spring, every river, every rock, mountain, palm tree, all of them had some special meaning to both peoples. And so we hear that story again and again. They reoccupied the Canaanite high places and did sin in the eyes of the Lord. You can see how difficult that would have been in a country like that. This is what makes Janice's quote from Wendell Berry of 2 weeks ago so significant to me. I'm just going to repeat it because I thought it was wonderful. It was a totally different message. But she quoted Wendell Berry saying, "I don't think it's enough appreciated how much an outdoor book the Bible is. It is best read and understood outdoors. Passages that within walls seem improbable or incredible seem outdoors to be merely natural." With Israel threatened by King Jabin's army, the Israelites turned to Deborah, who summoned Barak to draw up plans to defend the valley of Jezreel from Mount Tabor, while she worked to entice King Jabin to attack them there. The valley of Jezreel is claimed by four tribes, and it's often called the Garden of Israel for its productive and well-watered fields. But it was also close enough to the king of Hazor's territory for him to risk an attack inland by sea. Good planning can nullify any military advantage, and Deborah's charisma convinced people they could take this extraordinary risk and succeed. Yet you have to note that not everybody believed in Deborah. Only 6 of the 12 tribes of Israel showed up, and one can understand why. 4 of the 5 tribes closest to the valley of Jezreel or occupying part of it showed up, Naphtali, Issachar, Zebulun, and Manasseh. And the ones that were closely related to them, Ephraim and Benjamin, showed up as well. The rest, the ones that were further away like Dan and Gad and Judah and Reuben and Simeon, they said, this is not our fight. And the other one closest to them was Asher. Asher was right on the coast at the valley of Jezreel, directly between the hill country where the Israelites occupied and King Hazor's capital city at Sidon. We don't want any part of this. We'll be right in the middle. Only the 6 showed up. It's kind of like being in the Fraser Valley and assembling the tribes at Chilliwack Mountain and waiting for King Jabin to come from Bellingham, say, and White Rock and Vancouver, say, this is not our fight, and hoping this is not our fight, we're not coming. And maybe Aldergrove, the village, the tribe of Aldergrove, saying, whoa, 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 we're too close to Bellingham, we'll be spiked if you try to. And everybody else showing up from all around. So it wasn't a whole of Israel battle. Nevertheless, Deborah's charisma convinced everybody that they could succeed, and they did. The Canaanite chariots were stopped by a sudden flash flood that swelled the nearby Wadi Kishon and turned the battleground into deep mud. What an irony. Baal, the main god of the Canaanite forces, was the god of storms and weather, yet the Canaanites lost the battle because of a storm. Can you imagine the shock that must have been to the king of Hazor? In a similar way, I can't help but think as we approach September the 11th of the example of untutored Muslim villagers flying planes into office towers. The shock must have been every bit as great. What comes next, though, in Scripture profoundly disturbs me. After that magnificent story of Deborah, the story now focuses on an entirely different woman, one who has been made into a very masculine hero in Israel even to this day. Sisera, remember, the Canaanite general, is still alive. He flees on foot to the camp of Haber in Yale. They were nomadic tent dwellers, traveling tinsmiths who made farming utensils, domestic items, and weapons. It's possible that their campsite might have been close to the battlefield because Yale's family was making and supplying weapons for the army. Through her Kenite husband, Haber, Yale had kinship ties to the Israelites. Although Kenites were not Jews and stood outside the tribal structure of Israel, nevertheless they often lived among them and were bound to a certain extent by kinship obligations to them. But Haber, being a businessman, would have also been on good terms with the Canaanites as well. So it's reasonable that Sisera would have seen the encampment of Yael and Haber as a refuge. But look carefully. Sisera went into Yael's tent, not Haber's. The ancient laws of hospitality in the Middle East were very strict. A guest, once ritually invited into the home, had to be protected and cared for, even at the expense of everyone else in the house. But only the chief man of the household could offer that ritual hospitality, and that would have been Haber. Yael offered help to a fleeing general, but she could not offer ritual hospitality. Yet Sisera, rightly or wrongly, felt safe there. And what occurs later is one of the most graphic murders in Scripture. This is from Judges 5. She put her hand to the tent peg and her right hand to the worker's mallet. She struck Sisera a blow. She crushed his head. She shattered and pierced his temple. He sank, he fell, he lay still at her feet. In fulfillment of Deborah's prophecy, Sisera died at the hands not of a man, Barak, but at the hands of a woman. And Sisera's mother was left to watch and wait, as women have done throughout history, for her son to return. Out the window she peered, the mother of Sisera gazed through the lattice. Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarry the hoofbeats of his chariots? And so today, Yale gets all the glory in Israel. Deborah's prophecy is fulfilled, but her honor as one of Israel's greatest judges is never assured. She is often omitted from the record. As Elizabeth Cady Stanton says, how then should the church now teach that women should be silent in church, when among the Jews equal honor was already shown to women? I wonder that myself. Had my co-worker Hal been more manageable? Had his wife been more sure of herself to insist on the equal partnership that was her due? What great things could they have accomplished? And what praises to them both would we now sing? So I spoke earlier of the new covenant, a new model for women in the church, and I want to turn to the New Testament now. Christ's time was little different than the time before, or even from now, really. Women were still not honored as equals throughout much of the world, although in the higher strata of Roman or Greek or even Hebrew society, women often shared equal responsibility and power with their husbands, and occasionally even assumed it independently. There were Roman women, such as Cornelia, the mother of the wealthy Gracchi brothers, and Fulvia, who commanded an army and issued coins that bore her own image to pay her troops. They were powerful women. They owned land, ran businesses, all this without the help of men. Yet the Hebrew scriptures maintained that women remained the property of men and second-class citizens, despite the best efforts of Jesus to treat all as equals before God. So when we turn to this passage in Matthew, which you have with you, Matthew 27, 15 to 26, I've given you the whole passage, but I'm only going to read a little portion of it. We see a relationship between Pilate and his wife. Now, at the festival, the governor was accustomed to release a prisoner for the crowd, anyone whom they wanted. At the time, they had a notorious prisoner called Jesus Barabbas. So after they had gathered, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you? Jesus Barabbas, or Jesus who was called the Messiah?" For he realized it was out of jealousy that they had handed him over. While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that innocent man, for today I have suffered a great deal because of a dream about him." It's a fascinating line. Why would that have been recorded in the gospel? About Pilate's wife, we really know very little, except that she was a noble-born, Roman, well-educated, and wealthy. Early Christian tradition has named her Claudia Procula. She's considered a significant political power behind her husband's success. And the Orthodox Church has named her Saint Claudia. Pontius Pilate himself was of necessity a very political man. His patron in Rome was Sejanus, who governed Rome as regent after the emperor Tiberius retired to his villa at Capri. And Pilate would keep his position as the prefect or ruler of Judea only so long as Sejanus was satisfied that peace and stability were in the province. Judea was a very difficult and rebellious part of the empire, as I think we all know, and Pilate's job was far from easy. Many commentators call him cruel and oppressive, but Jerusalem was also a very turbulent city, especially at the time of the great festivals when the city was panicked with hundreds of thousands of pilgrims and rebellion was a constant threat. So Pilate traveled constantly, keeping an eye on each area of Judea, and likely Claudia, his wife, would have traveled with him. This may show something of the closeness of their relationship, since life in the administrative center of Caesarea would have been a lot more comfortable for her than life in Jerusalem in the Tower of Antonius. Perhaps he was accustomed to seek out her advice on difficult matters. Educated women were often quite powerful behind the scenes. We can think here of Livia's relationship with her husband Caesar Augustus at the time of Jesus' birth. Reading this gospel, one is inescapably drawn to the conclusion that Pilate was captured by a sense of justice in the fate of Jesus, and that Claudia, his wife, was captured by a sense of the mystical in the same way. One sense is that Pilate would have been happy to pardon Jesus, and that Claudia was definitely of the same mind. Yet Pilate was unable to do so without triggering a riot in the city. He was forced to disregard Claudia's request as well as his own conscience, and this he made plain in verse 24, where he says to the crowd, he washes his hands and he says, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves." In Scripture, Claudia Procula called Jesus this innocent man. Yet, had Pilate and Claudia found a way to follow their conscience and their mystical spirit and prevent Jesus' death, how then would God's story of redemption have been fulfilled? One finds Pilate and his wife reviled throughout the Christian church, and his wife is nearly completely ignored, actually. One finds Pilate reviled throughout the Christian church, and his wife nearly completely ignored. Yet the two of them perfectly model the struggle to be human in the face of God's calling to the world. How does one resist the call of God? I have a poem by Carol Ann Duffy about Claudia Procula. It's called Pilate's Wife, and I just want to read a couple of verses that really struck me. The night before his trial, I dreamt of him. His brown hands touched me. Then it hurt, then blood. I saw that each tough palm was skewered by a nail. I woke up, sweating, sexual, terrified. Leave him alone. I sent a warning note, then quickly dressed. When I arrived, the Nazarene was crowned with thorns. The crowd was baying for Barabbas. Pilate saw me, looked away, then carefully turned up his sleeves and slowly washed his useless, perfumed hands. They seized the prophet then and dragged him out, up to the place of skulls. My maid knows all the rest. Was he God? Of course not. Pilate believed he was. Other couples in the Bible provide evidence of great partnership. Priscilla and Aquila are the best known as two of the 70 disciples sent out by Jesus on the Great Commission and as saviors to Paul in his travels. And in nearly every place they are mentioned, it is Priscilla whose name comes first, as she is remembered as the one doing the teaching and instructing in theology and apologetics at all the early churches they led. They were martyred together shortly after Paul's own martyrdom. Other powerful couples who can model for us are Queen Bernice and King Agrippa, Abigail and Nabal, Ruth and Boaz, Joseph and Mary even, and those are some of the better known. And all speak to the truth that Peter spoke to the early church in Jerusalem on the morning of Pentecost, when all, men and women, slave and free, Jew and Greek, received the blessing promised by Jesus after his death. From Acts 2:16-21, Peter spoke, "No, this is what was spoken through the prophet Joel. In the last days it will be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Even upon my slaves, both men and women, in those days I will pour out my spirit, and they shall prophesy. Then everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved." God has spoken to us all. How long will it take my friend Hal to hear? How long will it take the church to hear? How long will it take the world to hear?